National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Iran and Israel achieved a tenuous ceasefire this week in the aftermath of the massive raid by the United States on Iran's main nuclear facilities. The question at hand, is lasting peace possible? This week on Register Radio, we're joined by EWTN News contributor Ambassador Alberto Fernandez on what has been called the most recent stage in a forever war. And then, a group of Benedictine monks in France have launched the world's first museum of Abbey wines. Their goal? To rebuild the civilization of wine, as they put it. We talk to Register reporter Solène Tadier. Hello, I'm Matthew Bunsen, host of Register Radio and EWTN News' Vice President and Editorial Director. I'm joined, as always, by Shannon Mullen, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register. Hello, Shannon.
Hello, Matthew.
I know this week you're in Phoenix for the Catholic Media Conference. How are things going out west?
They're very hot, but not that much different from D.C., actually, Matthew.
Slightly less humid, I hope.
It's a dry heat, as they say. Yeah.
Right. Little consolation, I understand. Well, as we all know, this last week, the United States delivered what U.S. intelligence describes as a devastating blow to Iran's nuclear capacity. A ceasefire between Iran and Israel subsequently ensued. But as our next guest writes, one thing that can be said of this war is that this is not exactly new. It is incredibly complex and comes with considerable historical baggage. Iran, the United States, and Israel have been repeatedly striking each other in a variety of ways, directly and indirectly, since the beginning of the Islamic Republic of Iran in 1979. The author of that is Ambassador Alberto Fernandez, an expert on the Middle East, a former U.S. diplomat, and a contributor at EWTN News. Ambassador, welcome back to Register Radio.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on.
Well, this is increasingly a full-time occupation, simply writing about various crises in the Middle East. I've almost lost count now how many times we've had the pleasure of relying on your expertise for the various conflicts that have erupted across the whole of the Middle East, in Syria, in Gaza, of course, and now in Iran and Israel. First, let's lay the groundwork a little bit. We are here toward the end of the week as we record this episode for the week. Where are we right now with the Israeli-Iranian conflict?
There's good news that the ceasefire has held. There's been rhetoric, there's been defiance, there's in the region right now, there's been a lot more calm than we've seen for a while, actually.
Yeah, so as we look at the strike itself, and one of the questions, there has been some controversy, obviously, relating to the strikes. Were they successful? Were they not? I guess the question from your standpoint, as somebody who is familiar with the intelligence community, were the strikes successful?
I think there's no doubt that they were extremely successful. Some of the controversy about this has been the old Washington, D.C. game of strategic leaking to embarrass your political opponent or the administration. But the preponderance of evidence is that this was a very heavy strike. It was very successful. In fact, we learned that the weapon that was used, this bunker-busting bomb, was actually developed 15 years ago, specifically for use against this specific target, a nuclear facility deep inside a mountain.
Alberto, you mentioned the Washington game. So, yeah, there does seem to be a pretty intense focus by many in the media on Trump's use of the word obliterated. It's not hard to see that an attempt is being made to kind of parallel George W. Bush's mission accomplished speech back in 2003 in the early days of the Iraq War. But in a sense, though, whether it's obliterated or not, does it actually matter as far as the message that President Trump delivered to Iran?
It seems like a very clear message in the sense that Trump has followed up on what has been a bipartisan U.S. policy for decades, which says Iran cannot have a bomb. The Democratic policy is Republican policy. He's carried it to the next level, and he's, you know, made it clear that going forward, if Iran tries to rebuild its nuclear capacity, the U.S. is willing to do what it needs to do. None of us want war, and the president certainly has been very aggressive about being dragged into some kind of open-ended conflict, but the policy is the policy, and it's not a new one.
Yeah, Fernando, Alberto, you talk about the fact that this is, as you describe it, a forever war. What do you mean by that phrase?
Well, the regime in Iran is a revolutionary regime. It came in to remake Iranian society and to usher in a specific kind of apocalyptic view of the world from Shia Islam. And from the beginning, claimed fervent, bitter, complete opposition against the United States and against Israel. I mean, that this was one of the goals of the Iranian regime, was death to America and death to Israel. And, you know, we in the West think, well, that's rhetoric and all of that. The Supreme Leader himself said, some of you think this is rhetoric. It's not rhetoric. It's our policy. And Iran, through the years, has followed up and has invaded U.S. embassies, attacked them, killed hundreds of Americans. In 1988, the United States and Iran fought a war in the Gulf, a naval war, which resulted in the destruction of most of the Iranian Navy at the time. This is Operation Praying Mantis under President Reagan. So there's a lot of conflict, a lot of blood. This is not something that just was invented by President Trump or by this administration. It goes way back.
And one of the assumptions that so many people make relating to the religious dimension to this, yes, this is an Iranian-Israeli conflict, but there is more complexity to that, isn't there? I'm thinking especially in terms of the ramifications and permutations of Sunni versus Shia.
Yes, there's been, we in the West think, oh, this is Israel against the Muslims or something like that, or the West against the Muslims. But actually, as far as the Sunni Arab Muslim world, there's been either a quiet satisfaction at Iran being hit, or actually open gleefulness by Arab commentators, bloggers, tweeters, etc., especially in Syria, where Syrians are basically saying, you know, what goes around comes around. Iran, which inflicted such suffering on the Syrian people, the Syrian Sunni Muslim people, is now getting payback.
Alberto, you mentioned the Supreme Leader Khomeini. He had disappeared, really. There was no word from him, or he hadn't been doing any direct communication. It seemed like just in recent hours or in the past half day, he has surfaced. Can you explain what is really his role and power? How does he himself factor into all of this?
Well, his power was, before this conflict, near absolute. As a kind of both political and religious leader of the state that had more power than the president of Iran, had more power than anyone else. What we don't know, and what many Iran watchers are speculating, is how much power does he have today? Many Iranians think that he actually made a big mistake, that he was too aggressive when he should have been diplomatic, and too weak when he should have been strong. You know, he dragged out and played games with the peace talks that President Trump had, and then he took on the Israelis and was militarily defeated. So there's a lot of questioning among Iranians, including in the leadership, and we actually don't know whether this man who has held such power for so long whether he's actually in charge anymore.
A quick follow-up, Alberto. How much censorship is there in Iran? Do we know? For example, the missile strikes on the American American base in Qatar, it was mostly kind of a symbolic thing, but it was described as this great triumph by the Iranian authorities. So how much does the Iranian people are able to know what's really happening here?
Well, there's a lot of censorship. Most Iranians cannot use the Twitter, for example, openly. Regime censorship is very strong. However, Iranians, the regime having been in power for 46 years, have learned to find out what's going on through different ways of either using anonymizers or alternate media or whatever. So the news is getting out, but censorship is very strong in Iran. Iran is a police state, and information is very regulated.
I guess one of the other questions that everyone is asking, is it possible to have regime change? Can this regime actually fall? And if it does, what would replace it?
Most people, I think, believe that if there is regime change, it's not going to come because of Israeli bombs or American bombs. It's going to come within Iran. It's going to come probably from within the regime itself. The fissures and the competition within the regime, for example, between the Revolutionary Guards and the army, between the religious leadership and the non-religious leadership. The personal ambition of one or several men is what is most likely to bring about regime change inside Iran. Unfortunately, it's probably not going to be the liberal masses in the street bringing about democracy. Very likely that the replacement in Iran will be a different type of dictatorship.
So would that be good news or would that be bad news, I guess, for the rest of the world?
None of us know. I mean, for example, chaos in Iran could be very bad. A country of 80 plus million people, 90 million people imploding, breaking into pieces, fighting amongst themselves could be terrible. And we have to remember that there are many Christians in Iran, many of them hidden Christians, or what people call house churches. Supposedly hundreds of thousands of Iranian Muslims who have secretly converted to Christianity. So in Iran, that obviously is internally in civil war, violence is a bad thing. But there's no really clear way of telling what the replacement would be.
Right. Well, we are going to find out, and I know that you'll be there helping to analyze all of it as we go. For those who's interested in the ambassador's piece, it's at ncregister.com. U.S. bombing of Iran is the most recent stage in a forever war. Well, Ambassador, thank you so much for your time again.
Thank you, Matthew.
Well, you're listening to Register Radio here on EWTN Radio. Next, we talk with Register Europe correspondent Solène Tadier about an intoxicating story, a museum of Abbey wines. Stay tuned to Register Radio.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And welcome back. I'm Matthew Bunsen, joined as always by Shannon Mullen, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register. As our next guest, Solène Tadier, writes in the National Catholic Register, at the foot of Mont Ventoux, in the sun-drenched southern French region of Provence-Alpes-Côte d'Azur, the Benedictine Abbey of La Bérue has become internationally known as a beacon of monastic renewal, drawing pilgrims from across Europe for its Gregorian chant, traditional liturgy, and fidelity to the rule of Saint Benedict. In the spirit of Ora et Labora, the monks have long cultivated the land as they have cultivated souls. Now, in what will be a world first, the community is preparing to build a museum devoted entirely to Abbey wines, not only as a tribute to a glorious tradition, but as an act of reconstruction, an invitation to recover what the monks call the civilization of wine. So Len Tadier joins us now to discuss what she calls a ripening story. So Len, I know that we could torture the imagery of this magnificent monastery and its efforts to restore, as you say, the civilization of wine. But first, thank you for doing this piece, because I think it's such a potent reminder of the importance of tradition and also the place of wine in European history.
Absolutely, Matthew. You're so right. These initiatives, and I called it on purpose, like the civilization of wine, because the monks are insisting on that. All the most beautiful things, most of the most beautiful things we enjoy in the West come from these monastic initiatives, and wine is a very strong part of it. And so they also had this kind of concern that, you know, de-Christianization also comes with, along with other symptoms, and this loss of appreciation for really good wine for them is a symptom of de-Christianization, because the loss of affection for beauty, for meaning, you know, people, like young people right now, they just drink to be drunk, you know, to forget about life, and that's absolutely not the main purpose of wine. And they really want to help young people to propose affordable wine at very high quality to help people rediscover the beauty of it on these very old vineyards that once belonged to popes many centuries ago, to really show that there is an enduring tradition, throughout centuries. And they invite people in the West, around the world, to rediscover the beauty of Catholicism also by drinking a delicious glass of wine.
So Len, this story has a lot of personal significance for me. Back in March 2021, you wrote the initial piece about this vineyard, the rehabilitation of the first papal vineyard in France thrills the wine world. This was maybe 3 months or so before I came to EWTN, and I remember reading it and thinking two things. One is, I've got to get some of this via Caritatis wine, which I did. I was able to get it. And it is fantastic, and I've reordered it multiple times since then. The second thing was, boy, Solène Tadier, what a great journalist. Never thinking that we'd be working together someday. So I'm thrilled that you've done this follow-up. And what they're proposing to do sounds incredibly ambitious. This isn't just a modern building that they're going to erect, this museum. It's much more involved than that. Can you describe what they envision doing?
Yes, they want it to be some kind of immersive experience. So they want the experience to be, you know, complete and to elevate the soul, and at the same time, you know, provide also delicious wine. So the structure, they said, will resemble a historic abbey. It will be the continuity of the abbey with arches, stonework, and they wanted to blend in this beautiful Provence landscape. So they wanted to be really French style, like this French monastic style. So there will be different floors, with one part for the museum itself offering immersive experiences of how the wine has been made by monks throughout the centuries. And there will be also a cellar below that will offer tastings. Not only, of course, they will provide their own wines, but they will also enable people to get to know other regional wines and other monastic wines. So it's going to be something very special. And yeah, I mean, I don't think there is anything like that has ever existed. I've been, you know, trying to find out more, but it looks like it's literally a world's first. And they really felt like they had the approval also, like this kind of divine approval, because they recently rediscovered the papal seal belonging to the Pope Clement V, you know, you remember, like the popes of Avignon.
Exactly.
So that was during this period when the papacy was brought to France, to Avignon. And so that's when the Pope started this vineyards. And so Pope Clement V, and his seal was casually discovered in a garden nearby by, a wine grower, a local farmer. So it's something for them extremely providential. That's why they decided to start this project, but with entirely private funds. So that's why they are asking, they are launching these campaigns internationally to ask all the Catholics around the world to support them while buying wine. They say, no, we don't want just money, but we want you to enjoy our wine. They want to provide the highest quality for an affordable price. So they say, every box of wine we sell is a stone that you are contributing a stone to the building. So they really want it to be a very enticing experience, a complete experience for everybody.
Yeah, one last question on this particular story, and it has to do with something that you write at the very end of your piece, that the Museum of Abbey Wines will be about communion between man and nature, man and history, and above all else, man and God. Could you talk very briefly about that? Because I think that's such an important point to come back to.
You know, wine was quoted over 400 times in the Bible, like the wine itself, but references to that. And wine is one of the many visible signs of God on earth. And that's why it's so important for monks to produce these things, to show the beauty that we cannot see God, but we can touch him through nature, through the miracle of nature. There are many things we take for granted, but all the beautiful things that are around us, nature and what we can make out of this nature, like wine. And that's a reminder of how great, just a foretaste of God's goodness, you know, the goodness that we will encounter after this life. We are pilgrims on this earth. And so wine is like this kind of communion, because it's something so exceptional when we think about it, the way it's made. It's incredible that we can turn it into an alcohol, and that it's slightly, you know, it's slightly relaxing when you're able to use it with temperance. And so it's a sign of divine charity, because it elevates the soul if it's properly understood and properly tasted. That's something very special. Each wine is unique, has unique flavors, unique smells, and you can recognize so many things. One will smell pepper and leather. You can find the most various, or even like for white wine, like mature fruits. Something so special that, of course, it can only be a foretaste of God's goodness.
Yeah. Well, while we have you, I want to pivot to another story that you've written, and that is A Tailor in the Pope's Service. And that is the tailor, Raniero Mancinelli, who has sewn and shaped the vestments of the successors of St. Peter for a very long time. And you have a profile of him as one of, I know, several papal tailors. But he really came a bit to the world's attention during this last conclave, didn't he?
Yes, also because he's 86 and he's been literally in this industry, he's been crafting these vestments for over 70 years. He has dressed four different popes, so he's like a real institution, like the same man. He opened his shop of Vatican II in 1962. And so after that, he's been like growing. He's made a name for himself. And so he has dressed St. John Paul II, Pope Benedict, Pope Francis, and now Pope Leo XIV. So of course, you know, he's like a very charismatic figure in this world. And of course, now with this new papacy, since, for instance, some like the mozzetta was not worn by Pope Francis, you know, the attention, the global attention was not really brought to these papal garments. But now with Pope Leo, since he has decided to reintroduce the red mozzetta, of course, people have, yes, have been asking questions. And so that's why Raniero Mancinelli, of course, attracted a lot of media attention worldwide.
Yes, I have a question for Matthew, actually. I'm fascinated by the fact that people are fascinated by what Leo is wearing now. And I know you're one of them.
yes, I am. Unapologetically.
Can you explain that?
Yeah, I think part of it is that we have associated with the papacy so many symbols and traditions, with the small t, of what the popes wear, the man in white, so to speak. But then also these great symbols of the papacy, the red mozzetta, for example, all of the pastoral staffs that they wear, the coat of arms of the Pope. I think part of it is that, especially today when we have lost touch with so much art and beauty, and the popes then represent that idea of continuity with the past, but also in so many ways what these things symbolize of the papacy itself. And it seems to me that Pope Leo XIV understands this rather profoundly, as he has almost subsumed himself, been subsumed into the role of the Vicar of Christ. And I look forward to seeing what other things he returns back to, for example, Castle Gandolfo, as we have much discussed. Well, Solène, thank you so much for all of your pieces this week. You can find Taylor in the Pope Service at ncregister.com, and I encourage everyone to read everything that Solène writes for us. Solène, a great pleasure to be with you, as always.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Well, that's it this week for Register Radio. Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks so much for joining us here on Register Radio, here on EWTN. Until next week, on behalf of my producer, Michael McCall, and Shannon Mullen, editor-in-chief of the Register, I'm Matthew Bunsen. Please take care, and God bless.